climate change, as you may know, we're doing absolutely nothing. Nowhere in the world is anything positive going on to slow climate change. Nothing. Zero. Even the plans are pure crap. In other words, nobody's doing anything. CO2 is increasing. Methane, which is a more powerful greenhouse gas, looks like it's going to get worse much faster than we expected because of the heating of the permafrost and so on.
That's Paul Ehrlich, our feature speaker this week on Radio EcoShock. Welcome. I'm Alex Smith.
Because people don't know what's important. We're having a presidential debate in which biodiversity hasn't been mentioned. Possibly, and I'm delighted to see what you're doing here, but possibly the loss of biodiversity is the single most threatening thing that's happening to us among a whole array of threatening things. And yet we've had a presidential debate now for almost 4 years. Hasn't been mentioned.
His 1968 book, The Population Bomb, awoke the world to the ecological and social threats behind exploding human population. Since then, Paul Ehrlich and his wife Anne have published dozens of books, many of them pioneering in fields like biology, evolution, and social affairs. His latest with Anne is The Dominant Animal and the Fate of Biodiversity. I was privileged to hear and record Paul Ehrlich speaking to a packed house at the University of British Columbia. All around Paul were priceless fossils and displays of now extinct species, just part of the collection awaiting the opening of the new Beattie Museum at UBC in Vancouver. In this speech, Ehrlich is hardly the ivory tower academic. He ranges over the multiple threats now facing humanity and the world species, not to mention the commercial and political insanity now rocking his own country, the United States. A warrior academic this week on Radio EcoShock. You get the whole speech, as I heard it, on September 24th, 2008.
It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Paul Ehrlich, Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University. So sit tight for a gripping lecture. From a right-wing neoconservative's perspective, you likely would never hear anyone as infamous as Dr. Paul Ehrlich. And they say that when you're making people mad, you must be doing something right. From that perspective, Paul is doing lots right. Seriously, though, it doesn't take a neocon infamy to show that Paul is doing lots right. He's more decorated than a grizzled army general, although much meaner. He's written more books than many people have read. And he's had a greater influence on public discourse and policy than just about any academic I've ever met. In terms of decoration, Paul has won dozens of major awards, including the John Muir Award of the Sierra Club, the Gold Medal Award of World Wildlife Fund International, a MacArthur Fellowship, the Crawford Prize of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, which is given in lieu of the Nobel Prize in fields where the Nobel is not given, the Volvo Environment Prize, and many more. And if I don't cut these lists short, then I'd take up all of Paul's time just with his many acclaims. His books make a splash. Most famous so far is The Population Bomb, which has its own Wikipedia page, a clear tug of war between neocons and environmentalists. Throughout his career, Paul's contributions have ranged from fundamental, rigorous population biology to social and political critique. In 2004, Paul published On the Wings of Checker Spots, a model system for population biology with Ilka Hansky, and also One with Nineveh, Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future, with his wife, Anne. His most recent book is The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, and that should be in the UBC bookstore and also, of course, online. Paul's influence on public discourse and policy is immense and also somewhat intangible. The Population Bomb changed the way that the world thinks about population issues. It's critiqued for projections, actually based on UN population scenarios, that many say are well off. I actually don't think they're so far off, and those that are off partly, probably, because the book had a much greater influence on international and national policies than Dr. Ehrlich might have imagined. With this hugely influential book, Paul contributed to the turning of the tide that was the human demographic shift, the great slowing down of human population growth within the last four decades, for which people everywhere should be thankful. Dr. Ehrlich founded the field of coevolution. He raised the specter of human overpopulation. And he's here to talk to you today about biodiversity and the dominant animal. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Ehrlich.
Thanks, Guy. How's the sound?
Yeah.
Can everybody hear? Okay, if not, start screaming. If you think I'm red-eyed, you're right. I burst the blood vessel in my eye listening to George Bush describe this. You know, you shouldn't knock neocons because they've all turned into socialists. You know, they spent the last 20 or 30 years trying to remove all regulation on financial instruments in the United States, and they pressured some people that I know. For instance, you got to remember that in this mess, there are a lot of poor people who really got screwed. They were sold mortgages they couldn't possibly afford because they didn't understand the conditions and so on. They take these dodgy mortgages and put them together, a whole bunch of lousy debt, into packages, which they then are transformed into structured investment vehicles and sold around and so on. And all of a sudden, the whole mess goes down the drain, and the people who, besides the people who've been screwed, the people who are the neocons, are losing money. And so what do? They want a $700 billion bailout, not from you guys, but it'll catch up with you too, from the citizens of the United States, from the very victim. So I'm a little bit annoyed. But I did come up here to relax. I was hoping to get an airplane. I'm a pilot and go out and gun down some wolves. But Kai was not able to arrange that for me. So what I'm going to do is give a lecture instead. And I'm going to restrict myself so we can have some time for discussion to 2.5 hours. And talk about the state of the world. And it's going to be a mixed bag. It's delightful, actually, for me to be back in Canada. Canada is my third home. My second is Australia. But back before most of you were born, I worked for the Department of Agriculture and Defense Research Board in the Arctic. Spent 3 summers in the far north, and it was a transforming experience in my life. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I find most impressive about the world, I'll come back to saying probably some things about cultural evolution later on, but one of the things that did for me was let me recognize what I call the culture gap, because in 1952, when I was living with the Inuit, I thought I told you people I was going to walk around. Do you want me to actually stop and talk into that? All right. It was an incredible experience, but one of the things in retrospect that I thought about is that every member of the Inuit group essentially had in their possession all the cultural information, all the non-genetic information of the group. The men knew what a woman's white knife was for and how to use it if they needed it. The women could actually go out and harpoon a seal through the ice. That wasn't their normal chore, but they knew there were no mysteries in it. And that's basically the way our ancestors were for almost the entire history of Homo sapiens. That is, everybody possessed the non-genetic information of their group, their culture. Look at us. There's not a person, collectively, we don't have 1/1,000,000th of the genetic information of our culture. All of us in this room, everybody who's educated. After all, how many people, there's probably somebody here that could do this. I certainly could. If somebody put a pile of complete set of computer parts in front of me, I couldn't begin to put together the computer. I certainly couldn't explain it to anybody. There's more cultural information in the 747 than there's genetic information in our genomes. And so everybody only has this tiny little bit of the cultural information of our society. One of the ways that this book got written was that Ann and I have been distressed by the fact that you can get all the way through Stanford University, and I suspect UBC, without having a clue about how the world works. I'll bet you that at least half of your faculty cannot tell you the difference between climate disruption and the ozone problem, or describe why people should be concerned. But certainly at Stanford, it would be 90%. I'm being really nice to UBC. You can get all the way through Stanford thinking that your food comes from supermarkets. We had a faculty member in computer science that thought that milk was manufactured. It's no small surprise that you get idiots like George Bush in high places, because people don't know what's important. We're having a presidential debate in which biodiversity hasn't been mentioned. Possibly, and I'm delighted to see what you're doing here, but possibly the loss of biodiversity is the single most threatening thing that's happening to us among a whole array of threatening things. And yet we've had a presidential debate now for almost 4 years. Hasn't been mentioned. Climate change has barely been mentioned. It's only mentioned on the websites. It's not mentioned in the debates. What's really important in the United States today, the critical issue facing society, is should gay people be allowed to get married? Yeah. My answer is yes. Why shouldn't they suffer like the rest of us? I mean, I don't see why there should be some special dispensation. So why did we call the book The Dominant Animal? Well, I don't think I have to convince this audience that Homo sapiens has been brilliant and risen to dominate the planet. And the domination is present all over the place. I mean, we have laced the planet with railroads, roads, our airplanes fly everywhere. We've now probably built on 3% of the land surface. We farm another 12%, roughly. We graze our animals on about another 25%. About another 30% is in forests that are exploited to one degree or another, and the remaining 30% is either under ice or in high mountains or extreme deserts where, curiously enough, there's very little biodiversity for us to threaten. But we are, of course, threatening biodiversity as we take over the planet. We now mobilize minerals more rapidly in most cases than natural processes of erosion. We now probably either take or divert or some way co-opt about 50% of the net primary productivity of the planet. That's basically the food supply for everything but green plants and some microorganisms. We've done it. I mean, we have gotten to the top. We are clearly in control, although I'd notice we named it the dominant animal because it's not at all clear, as Josh Lederberg pointed out many years ago, that we'll survive, that some virus won't come along and just take us all out. And in fact, lots of the things we're doing is encouraging that kind of denouement. So denouement. I have to tell you that the best quote I heard from George Bush on this trip, somebody told me on an airplane, is, "Do you realize the French don't even have a word for entrepreneur?" What can I tell you? So you got to keep your sense of humor in this world. Otherwise, there's no hope at all. So we've taken over the planet, but the paradox of dominance is we don't seem to be able to stop taking over. In other words, we're now undermining our life support systems. And, of course, the other organisms of the planet could best be described as the working parts of our life support systems. And as we take over more and more of the planet, co-opt more and more of the NPP, pave over more, farm more, and so on, we are beating up biodiversity at a level that I think makes it very clear, and I forget to come back to this, somebody could ask me, people now say we should call this the Anthropocene, the new geological epoch, and I think that's correct. But it's also we are already well into the sixth extinction, and the basic reason is that although we have not started losing species in terms of the total number that were lost at the time of at the KT boundary when the dinosaurs bit the dust, populations are being lost at an incredible rate, which is both clobbering our ecosystem services and, of course, eventually will lead to higher levels of species extinction. So if anybody says, why should UBC being concerned about biodiversity, it's the same thing as saying, why should UBC be concerned about the continuation of our civilization? The two are just so tightly linked. If you ever hear a politician say, we should concentrate on the economy and not the ecology, you know for sure you're listening to a moron, because the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the ecological systems of the planet. So here we are, we're dominant, and we are doing all sorts of things to shorten our tenure in that position. And let me run over... I sometimes call that the paradox of dominance. We've gotten to the top, we're Homo sapiens, and instead of doing something intelligent and building ourselves a sustainable society, we're wrecking our life support systems. And the best way to, to think about our wrecking of the life support systems is just to go back to the old heuristic iPad equation. The impact that a society has on its life support systems is a product of three basic things. One is the number of people in it. Second is the level of consumption of each person, which we call affluence because I pick it is harder to say than I pat. And T is a catch-all for the technologies and social, political, and economic systems we use to supply the consumption. And the good news, and the main good news in this story, and it's not all that really good, is on the population factor. That is, in the 40 years since the population bomb was written, we've really learned how to get birth rates down. And not only that, it turns out the very best way is to give women education, opportunities to control their reproduction, job opportunities, and so on, and you get a very dramatic drop in birth rates, particularly sometimes we did a study in Costa Rica about why when they did all those things for women, the birth rate dropped to the total fertility rate, the average family size is about 3, and then it leveled out. And it should be, you know, you want it to be somewhere around Italy, about 1.8. You want the 0.8s and the 0.5s so that you do have a supply of George Bushes if you need them. But and it turned out that what they'd done all those things for the women, but they've forgotten that men play a role in this, I'm told. I think it was mostly physicians that were doing the work, and they don't know where babies come from anyway. And when they refocused some of their attention onto the men, the TFR kept going down. And as you probably know, in Europe, many countries are either starting to shrink or on the verge of shrinking their populations. Exactly one of the places you want it to happen, because, of course, their impact on the planet is gigantic compared to, say, Bangladesh's, because they're such high consumers. Somebody want to guess what the most overpopulated nation in the world is? You have, sadly, a citizen of it standing in front of you. See, normally when I travel outside the United States for the last 8 years, I've claimed to be Canadian, because it's just too damn embarrassing. I was talking to Swedish and Norwegian government officials last week, and they're all looking at me saying, can you explain to me? And so, anyway, the U.S. is not only now the third most populous nation with 303-plus million people in it, which makes just we're only behind India and China. But, of course, when you factor in our consumption, our impact is huge. We use about 25% of the world's resources, something on the order of, you know, 5 or 6% of the world's people. But the projection is that we're going to go from 303 million to 439 million by 2050. Canada's got about 33 million, is going to go, I think, to about 42, which is a very substantial increase for a rich country, but nowhere near as substantial as the U.S. And no one has ever come up with even a semi-sane reason for having more than 140 million people alive in the United States, and we're scheduled to go to 439 and continue growing beyond that. The projections go to infinity, although I think the mathematicians of the audience will think that's probably unlikely. Anyway, that's the cheery story, because if current trends continue, the UN thinks that population growth in the world will level off somewhere around 9 billion people. Which, we only got 6.7. Now we're only going to add another 2.3 or 2.4 billion people, which is only about 400 million more than were alive when I was born. In other words, when I was born, there were 2 billion people on the planet. We're now at 6.7, going to 9. And what most people don't know is that if we have those additional people added, they're going to have a much higher impact on the life support systems than the last 2.3 or 2.4 million people, so a billion people. You know why? Because we're brilliant. We're Homo sapiens. Linnaeus named us the bright man, you know, the brilliant man. So guess what? People did not start farming the marginal land first and gradually move towards the river bottoms where they had rich soils. They didn't start drilling down 2 miles for oil and then slowly work their way to Pennsylvania where you can get oil by sticking a pointed stick in the ground. They didn't go to the places where water was really short and spend a lot of money to desalinate or depollute the water and then move to the rich river valleys. So, of course, I'm being ironic, I hope. So every person you add requires much more energy proportionally than the last person, because you've got to go to poorer resources, more distant resources, farm lousier land, use more fertilizer, on and on and on. So that's one of the bad things about the population story. And the second one is nobody has a clue whether or not we can possibly support even 6.7 billion people for much longer. In other words, if you've had Michael Clare here and he's talked about resource wars, we've been talking about resource wars for a long time. The first one was the 67 war in between the Arabs and the Israelis. What was it over? Does anybody remember? Water. And as a matter of fact, the only place I've ever considered an optimist is when I talk to earth sciences departments where people study water problems, because water is going to be a gigantic problem and probably the source of many more resource wars. Fortunately, this is gin, not water. I wouldn't. I don't want to rust my pipes. And, of course, we have our now failed resource war where we went and tried to grab the Iraqis' oil. By the way, there are still a few people who don't seem to understand that there never has been any teeny-weeny question about why we invaded Iraq. It never had anything to do with weapons of mass destruction or any of that crap. It's always been over oil. Even Greenspan said afterwards, the best quote on this comes from my colleague and one of Sal, your famous faculty member here, Sally Otto, who is a contribution to UBC, you owe us a lot, from Stanford. Her graduate student colleague, Gretchen Daly, said before the war, she said, do you really think we'd be invading Iraq if their major export were broccoli? You see, we have a government where nobody knows any history. The whole Middle East was designed around oil. If you want to blame somebody, you got to blame Churchill for switching his battleships when he was Lord of the Admiralty to running on oil, because oil has many advantages for running battleships over coal, not the least of which is if you're towards the end of your cruise when you get into a battle on a coal-fired battleship, you have to have almost all your men shoveling coal from the more distant bunkers to the boilers. Whereas, guess what? On an oil-powered battleship, you just turn a valve and there it is. Anyway, so we're having resource wars already. It's not at all clear that and the epidemiological situation, which we may talk about a little bit in the third hour, if I get there, are going to let us get to $9 billion. But if we get to $9 billion, of course, it will only be possible to have that as a point where we start sliding down towards an eventual sustainable population. We know we're overpopulated right now by the simplest of all criteria, and that is we can't live on our income from our natural capital. We're forced to destroy our natural capital. Our deep, rich agricultural soils, our fossil water from the last ice age that's in aquifers, and biodiversity, the most important of all. We're getting rid of all of it, and yet we depend on it. So we have to somehow get back to a level where we're able to live on our income from our capital, not just on our capital. So the population situation is the cheeriest of the situations. The consumption factor is much more difficult to deal with. I say on the population side, we know what to do. The reason we're not doing it is mostly political inaction, but it's not that we don't know how to do it. Literacy rates in women are still way below men, essentially, around the world. The treatment of women is bad in virtually every country. For instance, when Ann and I went to China about 15 to 20 years ago to talk to women about the one-child family policy, which abuses were much talked about by the neocons. It was actually the Chinese who announced the abuses and tried to do something about it. And in fact, one of our colleagues has had a lot to do with working with Chinese demographers on these issues. But they arranged at that time for us to have, I was a CBS correspondent, an NBC correspondent at the time, and they arranged for a quiet meeting with about 20 very well-educated Chinese women, and Ann and I wanted to hear their views on the one-child family. Took 2 minutes. Every single woman said, absolutely had to do it, right policy, we're totally behind it. And then one of the women said, I'm a great neurosurgeon. I will never be head of the team because I'm not a man. And then somebody else get in and said, I'm the best person they have in my firm, but I can never be president. I can be vice president because of my gender. In other words, a lot of these countries that sort of advertise how, the same thing, by the way, in Norway and Sweden, which you think of as very equitable countries, women don't get a break around this planet. They do a lot better than they used to. But gender and color differences, which are nonsensical on a biological basis, is hopefully all though, are still major things. Whether or not Obama wins will probably be controlled more by his skin color than the fact that he's three times as smart as his opponent. That's the way it goes. That's a biological fact. If I went through the evolutionary part of the text, I would have given you some details on that. The reason is very clear, again, from an evolutionary context of why we became sight animals, why we were small group animals that focused very much on things that sight bring to you, like skin color or shape or hair length or whatever. If we were smell animals, we'd have a very different world, believe me. Anyway, so the population may or may not be good. The consumption situation is grim for a lot of reasons. One is that most economists and most politicians think that the cure to every economic problem is go out and buy another SUV or refrigerator. The idea that you have to keep economic growth going, there are a lot of ideas about why we have that. The main one is that with growth, you can fool the poor people into thinking they'll eventually get rich. It doesn't happen, but the trickle-down theories, after we have more people hungry today than there were people when I was born. But the trickle-down ideas are very big and therefore keep the whole economy growing. But it's worse than that because the economists who are beginning to wise up to this and look at it, some of the best economists in the world, have not yet done the work to decide how you would control consumption. It's very easy at one level for the rich to say, yeah, if the choice is, does anybody here got $30 million in their pocket just by chance? U.S., not Canadian. Well, you have a choice. You can go out and buy an executive jet or a Van Gogh. And it's clear from the environmental point of view, the Van Gogh is a better example. But as you move down the scale, of course, it's more difficult to figure out what are wise choices and how to control them. It's not simple like the population size thing, but it gets even worse than that because, of course, there are probably 1 billion people and maybe 2 billion who should be consuming more if they're going to have decent lives and be able to contribute to society and so on. So the consumption problem is really hairy. And when you put the two of them together, of course, what do you get? You get the various things that are driving us down the drain. So the one, when people think about environmental problems, and I give you an example. We had in 2004, we had a press conference at the National Press Club, and the issue was to try and bring environmental issues to the table for the election because nothing was going on, just like this time. Every single question, every one, was about climate change. Not one touched on climate change's impacts on biodiversity, which is one of the critical things about it. In fact, matter of fact, there are a number of things deadly wrong with this current situation with climate change. First of all, let me say, I think it's a horrendous threat. It may be the biggest threat humanity faces, but it may not. There are a whole series of other things I'll talk about that may end up being worse. Second of all, if you talk to the average person about what they're worried about climate change, it's whether or not their beachfront home is going to be soaked by sea level rise. Now, sea level rise is the one thing that's close to certain with climate change because, of course, even if we didn't have glaciers to melt, water expands when it gets warmer. The main direction of climate change or climate disruption is what we now are trying to keep calling it because it's not just warming sounds too cozy. The water will expand. Sea level will rise. But I can almost promise you here that you'll be able to outwalk the rise. It's not going to be something that's going to dramatically affect your lives. Think about it. We've probably already entrained close to 1,000 years of continual change in precipitation patterns, the precipitation patterns upon which our ability to feed even 6.7 billion people, many of them not well, utterly depends. We're melting, for instance, the so-called Himalayan water tower, which is all the glaciers of the Himalayas and which provide the continual flow of the rivers of South Asia, is disappearing. Same thing in Peru. Lima's water supply is disappearing because the glaciers are melting. And remember, it's not just how much rain falls and flows to the sea, it's the pattern of flow. You know, if you had all winter here rain and then no rain in the summer, you'd have a tough time with your rain-fed agriculture because the water would all go out to sea when you can't use it and not be around. Not only is about 1.3 billion people are dependent for their water on the Himalayan water tower, and the very same areas we have the rice and wheat is growing within a degree or two of the maximum temperature at which they can produce. And guess what? Everybody know the CIGAR group here, the Consultative Group in International Agricultural Research, the IRI, the Rice Center, CIMMYT in Mexico, and maize. The only reason we are able to feed at any level 6.7 billion people is the activities of plant geneticists. It's that pure and simple. And there are about 9, I think it is, institutes around the world that are the centers of plant genetics aimed at agriculture to feed people, not aimed at agriculture to develop strains that you can control and that only your herbicide will work on and so on. And they're being defunded. They're close to broke. And we're talking about a few million dollars that they don't have. And the money is not going to them. One day's aviation gas cost for us bombing Iraq would put them all in great shape for months and months, or maybe even years and years.
You are listening to a lecture by Paul Ehrlich, author of The Population Bomb, and now his new work with wife Anne, The Dominant Animal. We'll be back with the rest of this exciting speech after 30 seconds for station identification.
rising and rising and rising, then it falls just like us and the wind.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. We're listening to a speech, The Dominant Animal, by Paul Ehrlich. He's the author of The Population Bomb, and he spoke at the University of British Columbia on September 24, 2008. Let's get to that speech.
We are in deep, deep trouble. Rice is the single most important crop of human beings, and there's been no progress in yield now for decades, and lots of problems with pests and so on. We tried some years ago, actually, to put together a joint Stanford-Erie project to look at the conservation condition of rice relatives. There are about 14 species of oryza that we don't farm, and a lot of the genetic material which has given us the so-called miracle rices didn't come from the species we farm, but from other species, and we couldn't get $1 million to look into it, even though in some sense the fate of much of humanity sits on whether or not we keep rice going. Anyway, so climate change is a horrendous future problem. If you think of, I'm going to make the numbers up, but they're within a few points. I think something like 40% of our food comes from the 17% of our land that's irrigated. And if you think that we're going to have to change, it isn't a matter of going from one situation to another, but there's going to be constant change in precipitation patterns for 1,000 years. The cost in infrastructure alone, if we manage to do it, is going to be ungodly. You're going to have to tear down dams in some places, put them up elsewhere, put canals in different places, pumping systems more. It's conceivable we'll get to the point where we can use desalinated water for some kinds of agriculture, although nobody's looking. Unfortunately, salt water tends to be mostly in the seas. The agriculture doesn't tend to be all that much sometimes on the seashores. But if you got to both desalinate water and pump it in, you get into the energy problem. And of course, there we are. Should we be struggling to get Iraqi oil? It's sort of invading for cyanide, right? Even if we cut back the coal, there's more than enough oil already discovered to take us well past 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. And we're having arguments about where to drill for oil in the presidential election, where the answer is nowhere. We've got to get off the fossil fuel standard. Everybody knows that. We had politicians who talked in the presidential campaign about taking off the taxes on gasoline, when every single economist I know think the taxes on gasoline should be much higher. You're not internalizing the externalities, for instance, unless you take the 85 or 90 cents per gallon that we pay in military costs to keep the oil flowing. Half of the U.S. military budget is designed to keep oil flowing towards the United States. Never mind. Anyway, so there's biodiversity stuck in the middle of all this because, of course, as the climate changes, as hopefully you all know, we're going to have more and more problems maintaining the organisms that we need to run our life support systems. We're already in trouble for pollination in the United States because of colony collapse disorder in the bees. Now, the bees are an imported organism. So, you know, what pollinated our crops before? Things called native bees. Where are the native bees now? Well, mostly destroyed through habitat destruction. It's not at all clear. Nobody's done the study yet whether if the honeybee disappears entirely, we'll lose the full $17 or $18 billion worth of crops that are pollinated by the honeybees, or whether there'll be some chance of native pollinators picking up the slack. But it's going to be a close call. You all know about carbon sequestration. You all know about flood prevention and so on. All of these organisms, the populations that are being wiped out, the biodiversity we're losing is going to play back directly on us. And climate change is going to make it more difficult to maintain the biodiversity because the organisms often can't move to keep up with the climate change. And you may build a nice big reserve somewhere, and then the climate moves away. What do the organisms do? Well, usually the reserve is surrounded by farmland or industrial areas or what have you, and the organisms can't migrate. So biodiversity and climate change are very tightly tied together. But as I said, climate change may not be the most serious problem we're facing. Land use change is so tightly tied to, I won't say anything separate about that, but that has to do with how much we pave over and so on, and some people think that's a more serious problem. The one I would nominate as the strictly environmental type problem that may be much worse is toxification of the planet. Why do I say that? Well, here in Canada, you hear about polar bears, gonads dropping off, and, you know, in some of your subarctic towns now, there are twice as many female babies being born as male. Not a clever sign. Frogs are three-legged around the world now. Alligators are turning out to be intersexes. And all this is somehow related to the toxic chemicals we're introducing to the environment, not just the straightforward toxins, but maybe even more important, the hormone-mimicking chemicals, which may have nonlinear dose-response curves. For instance, they may affect you more in small doses than in large doses because of the way the cells regulate the number of receptors they have available for them. I mean, we're Homo sapiens again. Some clever chemists put together a compound called bisphenol A, hoping that it would work well in the pill for women, in contraceptive pills, a female hormone. It wasn't quite powerful enough to use in the pill, so they now put it in baby bottles so that, you know, babies around the world are getting a dose of artificial female hormone at the most sensitive time. Not, again, very sapient. But worse than this, we don't know anything about these chemicals. There have been no real cost-benefit analysis on their use or sticking into the environment. I mean, to give you an example, some of these things are developed for really important things like making eyelash glue stick harder, or making sure that your gun oil polishes better, that sort of thing. I mean, it's we know nothing about most of them in their direct effects on human beings or on the environment, or in their synergistic effects. And when you have a possibility of synergisms between something like 100 or 200,000 compounds that are now out there from pole to pole, you have a real problem. But why would it be worse than climate change? Well, for climate change, as you may know, we're doing absolutely nothing. Nowhere in the world is anything positive going on to slow climate change. Nothing. Zero. Even the plans are pure crap. In other words, nobody's doing anything. CO2 is increasing. Methane, which is a more powerful greenhouse gas, looks like it's going to get worse much faster than we expected because of the heating of the permafrost and so on. But at least with climate change, we have crackpot ideas of what we might do if we get really into trouble. You know, like putting space shields up there to get the sun away, keep the sun away, or dumping tons and tons and tons of iron filings into the ocean, and so on. Now, these are really insane. I mean, compared to putting a tax on carbon, where we know exactly how to do it, we already have the apparatus in place, and if it isn't working with a stroke of a pen, you can change it. These are crackpot ideas. But we don't even have crackpot ideas. If it turns out a synergism between seven of the compounds we've released, make everybody sterile. What are you going to do? Get the graduate students out there with forceps pulling those molecules back out of the pole-to-pole environment? So if we go down the drain and things are looking more and more serious on the toxification front, nobody has any idea how to come back. We don't even have crackpot ideas for that. And, of course, I don't want to go through this litany much further without mentioning what may be the thing that will kill almost everybody in this room, most likely, if you want to pick out a non-natural, if you don't want to consider it natural death, of course it's a vast epidemic, because as the population grows, we become more and more susceptible to novel epidemics. Why? Well, for one thing is all of our infectious diseases came originally from other animals. And what we're doing is pressing larger and larger groups of people into closer and closer contact with the reservoirs of disease. This has been crystal clear for many decades, much more. I was writing about it in the population bomb. Not I knew anything about it, but because the literature was rich in this sort of thing. So you're putting more and more people into contact with disease vectors. That increases the chance of a jump, that one of the diseases will move from, as the others all have in the past, like AIDS, will move from the animal reservoir into people. A whole bunch of people look very carefully. There's some biodiversity. Come on in, cheap over here. There's been a lot of work done on epidemiology, and it turns out that you have to have certain size populations before really nasty diseases will become endemic and you will take hold in your population. In other words, you have to have a town of, I think the calculation is somewhere between 50,000 and 500,000, depending on the conditions, before if measles jumps into a population, whether measles can stay or will die out. Why would it die out? Because people either recover and are immune or they die, and then there's nothing for the measles to do, so it's gone, unless you have a big enough population that reproduction and everything keeps things going. So, again, the more people we have, not only the chances of the disease moving into the population are higher, but the chances of the disease staying in the population are higher. And then we have this wonderful high-speed transport system. In 1750, if a plague ship left Japan for India, nobody in India caught the plague, because everybody died before they got there. One cabin attendant in a 747 infected women with AIDS on four continents in a week. That's a very different kind of situation. And, of course, topping it all off, we have more and more, in actual numbers, malnourished people all the time who are then immune compromised and more likely to pick up the diseases. And guess what? It's also bad for biodiversity. You know, you get two cases of West Nile here in Vancouver, if it were the United States, I don't know whether you have or not, that you would call out the helicopters and, you know, spray fuming nitric acid over the entire place. That's what happens everywhere. So that when these diseases come up, the reactions to them usually are not planned and thoughtless and usually very bad for biodiversity in one way or another. So the epidemiological environment is not trivial. And I also have to mention, because of my own interests and yours too, that the U.S. and Soviet Union still, and Russia still have, it was going to be a democracy till the neocons got hold of it, but didn't work out that way. Does somebody here know how many nuclear missiles we have pointed at each other? How many warheads, roughly? Still several thousand. In other words, we have on a hair trigger alert in Russia thousands of nuclear missiles, big, high megatonnage bombs, pointed at us, probably at Canada too, since you're sort of thought of as a localized colony of the United States, unfortunately. During the nuclear winter studies, John Holder and I got drunk one night and calculated how many Hiroshima-sized bombs, that's firecrackers by today's standards, it would take to end the United States or Russia as functional entities. That time we probably had something in the order of 20,000 warheads pointed in each direction. The numbers we came up with were 12 for the United States and 10 for Russia. And all you got to do is think for a minute. If you hit the transportation centers in the United States, you blow up New York to end the financial system and Washington to end the confusion. And after that, you take out Kansas City, Chicago, New Orleans, L.A., San Francisco, a couple of other places. Transport system breaks down. Everybody starves to death. In other words, if you just stop the system from moving stuff around, it's all over. And it turned out, to our amazement, that Russia has fewer nodes that have to be hit than the U.S. to get down the drain. We still have thousands of weapons pointed at each other. The Russian command and control system is badly deteriorated. It's just been a miracle. And now, of course, we're starting to get into conflicts over things like the Georgia business. And I was talking to a Norwegian government official last week, and he said, what can a poor country, a small country like Norway, do to help the world situation? I said, well, you almost ended the world in 1996. Isn't that, you're really powerful. And he said, what are you talking about? We almost ended the world in 1996. Well, in 1996, in a relatively little-known incident, the Norwegians decided to send up a research rocket, a sounding rocket. And they told the Russians it was going to go to that, as is the normal procedure. But the Russian, probably the guy who was in charge, was so soused with vodka or out picking potatoes because the system had collapsed so far, the word never got through. So they got it on their radar, and they set out attack from the United States. And they got 8 minutes into their 15-minute countdown for launching everything they had at us, which would have been the end of Canada, the United States, and the world. So Norway could be a really powerful country. On the other hand, even relatively small countries like Canada can have enormous impact in the world. Many of you, I can't see how old most of you are. We should have the lights up. But it doesn't matter. You must remember Lester Pearson. you know, Eric, a Canadian diplomat who had enormous impact on the world and on how we think about aid programs and so on. So that's the cheerful litany. And now I got to tell you, in the last hour and a half, what are we going to do about it? What should we do about it? Is there anything to do about it? Well, I think the best answer is to drink a lot, keep your internal environment in good shape while you watch the external go down the drain. I mean, it seems to be the cleverest way to go about it personally. But should you happen, unlike our president and his buddies, care about future generations, then there are other things we ought to be thinking about, and particularly in terms of the biodiversity crisis. One of my colleagues, Rob Pringle, and I wrote an article for the Proceedings of the National Academy on this. The basic answer is there are no quick and dirty single silver bullets. We have to do a whole huge number of things if we're going to manage to save biodiversity and with it ourselves, because you never want to lose the connection. There's no way you get rid of biodiversity and we just go on in a totally artificial world continuing to manufacture our milk. And what are some of the things? It's a long list. One, of course, is to get at the drivers. You have to somehow find a way to bring population growth to a halt as rapidly as possible, particularly in the rich countries, and start a gradual decline by humane methods until we get down to a number that is sustainable. What's a sustainable number? I don't even worry about it, because, of course, it depends, first of all, on what your peak is. Second, that is, how much is left to support people in the future. Second is, what kind of lifestyle do you want to have? Is it going to be what Gretchen calls the battery chicken lifestyle? Maybe even be possible to maintain 6 billion people permanently in the battery chicken lifestyle, but I don't think many would choose it. If it's the Beverly Hills millionaire lifestyle, you have a totally different number. But why don't I want to worry about it? We're not going to peak out, even if we do, you know, even if we work at it very hard, till late in this century. And if you do it humanely, it's going to take at least another century to get down to something that's nearly sustainable. That gives you maybe 150 years to have the discussions, which I think should be starting right now, about what people are for. Are we really there just to buy automobiles, and things like that? Or are, you know, what kind of lifestyle we want and how we move in that direction? So what we know today is we're already overpopulated and stressing the planet more and more all the time. And so we could easily do the planning, and it's going to take a long time to get at any target level because, again, we're going to get much more overpopulated before we start going back down. Same thing with the consumption problem. We should be working right now on how you reduce consumption, how you design an economic system that doesn't depend on more physical throughput all the time. The best economists, the best news I have on the academic front is that for the last 20 years, ecologists and economists have been working closely together on these issues, and it's the best of the economists that are doing it, not the ones who write for the Wall Street Journal, who would take everything I've said tonight and say they're just externalities, you know, not to worry about it. As Herman Daly, an economist, said about 20 years ago, if the survival of your civilization is external to your model, you probably need a new model. And we do need new models, and we've got to start moving rapidly to get them. And at a more specific area, what sorts of things would we be doing? Well, obviously supporting things like the center here, doing everything you can to restrict, you know, instead of tearing up natural areas to put in strip malls, we should be tearing up strip malls to put in natural areas. We should be working in every way we can to transition away from the automobile-centered environment. For instance, if I were king of the United States, don't wait, don't hold your breath, I would make an announcement that the last 70 or 80 years, we've made a deliberate effort to transform the United States to serve automobiles rather than people. Was funded originally by the automobile industry, the rubber industry, and the oil industry, the LA being a classic example. But there's no reason why you should have millions and millions and millions of people driving a couple hours a day with several tons of steel wrapped around them to get to and from work. There's all kinds of ways we could redesign our cities. And in fact, the economic situation with oil prices where they are was beginning to start that. In other words, housing prices started to go down in the slurbs. The slums of tomorrow are not downtown anymore. They're in these totally radiated places where people have to drive, you know, long distances to get to work. I mean, they can't afford it. As I say, housing prices have already reacted in the United States. I mean, automobiles are fantastic things for teenagers to make love in. We should keep them around for that purpose. But as things to commute in, they're just ghastly. And that's the kind of change we need. In other words, when you hear we're going to do it with plug-in hybrids or this sort of thing, in other words, we're going to maintain our basic lifestyle with sort of technological fixes. It hasn't worked in the past. I don't see any sign that it can work in the future. So we should be doing everything we can to pull the suburbs back in, to concentrate people living in tighter areas, and as their population goes down, that ought to be easier and easier to do. We've got to do a lot in what Gretchen Daly calls countryside biogeography, that is, finding ways to make areas that are already badly disturbed by human beings, and there's lots of them, more hospitable to biodiversity. And there's a lot of ideas on this and a lot that's been started, but all, again, only at a test scale, nothing at the level that needs to be done. There's also rewilding. There's the fact that you could turn a lot of North America back into semi-wilderness without damaging the economy much at all, because it mostly involves places that are now basically deserted. So there's a lot that could be done there. A lot could be done legally in reserve protection. Lots of problems in the poor countries on how you preserve areas. Probably in poor countries it's going to have to be entirely countryside biogeography. That is, the growth rates still are high in the population. The people are desperately poor. If you didn't have any fuel to cook with and were living next to a pristine tropical forest, guess what you'd do? Just what I would do. You're going to chop down one of the trees and use it to heat the water so you can take the grain and actually eat it. So much more countryside biogeography there. Much more aid is going to be required. One of the things that scares me and a lot of other people is there is a basic idea, it is sort of the neocon idea, that you could wall off 3 or 4 billion people and just let them go. In other words, that's the basic plan when you get right down to it. I mean, we are, if you've probably heard the complaints of farmers in poor countries about competition with the subsidized farming operations in Europe, in the United States, and Japan. In countries where the average income of a person is somewhere between $1.25 and $2 a day, European cows are subsidized to the tune of $2.50 a day. If you think people in the third world don't understand what's going on, they do. And what appalls me is that the people in the rich countries don't seem to understand that people in the third world are increasingly getting nuclear weapons. You think they're just going to starve quietly? I mean, what do you think the basic complaints are? Why are all these people being able to be recruited into outfits like Al-Qaeda and so on? It's just because the poor people of the world have been screwed over thoroughly by the rich for a very long time. They're getting tired of it. So even if we're going to be selfish about it, just trying to wall them off isn't going to work. They're not going to just disappear quietly. But that's the trend right now. You know, all the wealth gaps are opening up within countries and between countries. And if you think we can solve these problems with a world divided into very rich people and very poor people, I think you're mistaken. So I think that one of the things we have to do is get on the equity issues and really hard, and that's going to be a big problem. I think it's fair to say that all of my colleagues agree that the scientific community, while we have differences and areas where we're very uncertain, we know basically what directions humanity ought to be moving if we're going to go in the right directions based on what we know now about science. A good example is it's certainly better to try and keep the greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere than to try and take them out once they're in there or do something else about it, you know, do the sun shield or what have you. We know that we shouldn't be running. Biologists could have told you 50 years ago that it's nonsensical to think that women or people with darker skins are some way less intelligent or able to do things than Sarah Palin has certainly set this back. I mean, we've known that for a long time, and yet we're still running presidential campaigns where this is a big issue. And so we know what needs to be done. It's very clear. And again, we know how to control population. We don't know enough about consumption, but we know where the problem is, and there are lots of ideas you could come up with fast for changing the consumption patterns. But for some reason, we can't do it. Human behavior has not moved in the right direction. It's not hard to figure out why. We have been extraordinarily brilliant and successful on the technological side. Our cultural evolution in technology has gone at a dazzling rate. Imagine if you were a Martian archaeologist coming here 50 years after our civilization has totally collapsed and everybody's dead, say in 2030, and they excavate New York year 2000 and London year 1500. Exactly the same organism created those two technologies. We know that. But you would think there was different genera, different families. You couldn't imagine. Just imagine the difference in technology between 1500 and today. Now, at the same time, if you talk to an ethicist today, he'll say, well, you know, most of philosophy today is just footnotes to Plato. In other words, the ethical situation today would be totally understandable to Plato, even though the technological situation would be Disneyland to him. You couldn't even grasp it. Or is our evolution on the ethical side? I'm not saying we haven't had any. It's been slow. I mean, you can no longer beat a horse to death on Vancouver streets if you own it, even if you own it, without getting into some trouble, I suspect, with the authorities. But nonetheless, the ethical evolution has been extraordinarily slow, and the technological evolution has been incredibly fast. And so one of the things that a bunch of us are trying to do is mimicking the IPCC, in part the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or you all know about the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which was finished a few years ago, about 2,000 scientists working on it and so on. We want to start a Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior. But it would be less, it would be some research, but it would be mostly outreach and getting people to talk about what they want, what's valuable in their lives, what makes them happy. For instance, the economists repeatedly do studies of satisfaction, and as the U.S. GDP has quintupled, satisfaction is, if anything, gone down. In other words, it's not at all clear that our buy more gadgets sorts of things is actually making people happier, their lives better. In a very personal example, when Ann and I went to Stanford, we didn't really get a living wage, but it was enough so that Ann was able to stay home with our child for the first 5 years without going out to work. I don't know a single young professional couple today where both people don't feel they have to work. And that's not, you know, I don't think that's advanced in society. So we were hoping, and we may eventually get a Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior together to try and look at some of these issues and change things. Is there anything cheery I can tell you? Only thing cheery I can tell you is that, as I probably said here a few years ago, human societies we know can change extremely rapidly when the time is ripe. And all you have to do is think of the one man, and that's Truman, changed the U.S. in fantastic ways simply by desegregating the military. World War II was an event which basically totally changed U.S. society. It was what gave women the chance, and not far enough, but incredibly. I mean, if you were a woman in 1938, you could be a school teacher in the lower grades, you could be a nurse, or you could be a secretary. That was it. I can remember myself in 1947 arguments about whether a person with a dark skin could actually play baseball. His name was Jackie Robinson, and my team was the Dodgers. And I remember one of the outfielders quitting because he wouldn't serve on a team that had somebody with a dark skin. Things have changed. There were no, in the movies, the only person with a dark skin you ever saw was a janitor. I mean, things have changed, and they changed quite rapidly in the 60s. And if you don't believe that, some of you are old enough to remember when there was a thing called the Soviet Union. All of my sophisticated international relations friends, not a single one of them, thought that the Soviet Union would collapse and communism would essentially disappear over much of the planet. But it happened. So there is some chance when the time is ripe that we will be able to change the way we treat both our environment and each other. I hope so, but I think our main job, as I've said many times, is to find ways to ripen the time. Thank you very much.
That was Paul Ehrlich, the award-winning scientist and author, recorded at the University of British Columbia on September 24, 2008. The evening celebrated the development of the new Beattie Museum in Vancouver, Canada. You can download this lecture and all our past programs as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. If you're looking for the underlying causes of the global financial crisis, be sure to download the Radio EcoShock program for October 3rd called The Prolonged Crash. We cover it all there. My thanks to the Beatty Museum at UBC and Paul Ehrlich for permission to broadcast this speech. Look for his new book, The Dominant Animal and the Fate of Biodiversity. And thank you so much for listening.